Hi everyone, and welcome to another podcast of Globalize Asia. It's never easy to put yourself out of comfort zone of an established career and start a venture from scratch. Our guest today, Rohini Rathore, has just done that and more. She's a life and business coach who aims to help and empower individuals and small and medium enterprises to exceed in their personal and professional goals. Rohini started her venture after 15 years of successful stint at wealth management firm in the City of London. She is also an author and a trustee to a charity that aims to help kids in slums of urban India. Let's hear it from the very wonderful Rohini Rathore.
So hi Rohini, it's a pleasure having you with us today, and hopefully we'll have a really interesting conversation with you. So tell us, how did you get into wealth fund management?
Thanks so much for having me today. It's an interesting story how I got into it. I think I had spent probably about 5 or 6 years here in London already trying to work out what it was that I wanted to do as a career, because the plans I had made when I finished my MBA in India didn't quite turn out as I had expected, and we can certainly, you know, talk about that later on. But as I sort of slowly discovered what I really wanted to do, and I did some professional investment management exams, and I discovered I actually really enjoyed how relevant what I was learning in that course was to real life, you know, things you could see in the stock market, you could see how companies were behaving. And I just got my first really good break when a friend of my husband's offered to let me work for him, you know, in his fund management firm that he just started, which focused on emerging markets. So I spent, the thing is, it was just purely work experience. So he wasn't actually offering me a job, but he was giving me an opportunity to come and just be part of a team that was actually managing money. And I really enjoyed that experience, and I took from there a real sense that that was going to be my career. And so, it was April, I think it was April 1997, that I came across a headhunter who, you know, sometimes you meet someone and you finally feel that they really get you, that you have this moment of thinking, at last, somebody who really understands me and sees what my potential is. And so he placed me for an interview with this little firm, which was mainly a private client manager. And yes, and never looked back since. And that was in 97. So until 2014, early 2015, when I left, I stayed with the same company.
So nearly 2 decades then.
Yes.
So tell us how then a leading fund manager in London eventually finds himself as a career or a business coach.
Look, I absolutely loved my job as a fund manager. And I think what made it so interesting is that I worked for a firm which was quite unique in many ways. You know, they had a very different way of looking at managing money. We're talking about 20 years ago, when a lot of traditional UK money was very much, you know, what's in the benchmark, you know, what's in the index, and basically we'll, you know, tweak around it a little bit, but essentially we're going to buy these big companies that make up most of the index. And here we were, you know, sort of what in those days perhaps called ourselves the pioneers of global investment management. We just didn't start from the benchmark. We sort of said, look, we're going to look for some interesting long-term investment themes, and then we're going to find the companies, no matter where in the world, to see if they fit those themes, and we're going to buy those companies. And actually, the thinking was that if these themes were right, then actually it didn't really matter which country you were in. And this was also the time when globalization was becoming a big thing. Companies were becoming much more adventurous, you know, going to new markets, they were going to emerging markets. And even if you looked at, say, big companies in the UK, they didn't really have that much pure UK exposure. They were all scattered around the world. So why not make your investment process to be led by the same things that were attracting these companies? And it worked beautifully, and it was so exciting and so interesting and so liberating to not have, you know, a list of companies that you were forced to buy, but just maybe have a little bit of freedom, whether you buy less of or more than what's in the benchmark. The fact also that, you know, there were so many different niches that I could build upon within the company meant that even though I was there for 18 years, I wasn't doing the same job for all of that time. So your question was, how did I get from that to... Sorry, I do get a bit carried away. So I think the thing that I discovered in my time there was that I was much more attracted to potential than to perfection. So there are some people who look at a great company and they say, yeah, I have to own this because it's such a good company, it's doing all the right things. I was one of these people who'd look at companies that were unloved, poorly understood and undervalued and think, you know what, if these people had the right management team, if they did a few things differently, just imagine what these companies could do. Right. And then to actually become an investor in these companies and support them, you know, with a little bit of, you know, external perspective, maybe support them when they needed funding, you know, you could really have a quite an important part in that transformation. And although it was tough sometimes because people wouldn't understand, they would think I'd gone completely mad. But over time, I got a bit of a track record of actually spotting potential and actually making money from it. So to cut a long story short, you know, I did that for nearly 20 years. A few things changed, you know, both within my company, in my personal life, and also in the markets. And I just felt that there are a number of things that were so dear to me and how I had actually run money were just not working. They were not working because of the external environment. They were not working perhaps because I had got a bit stale in my job because I'd been doing, you know, I was head of UK equities when I left and, you know, I was overseeing £2 billion of money. And I'd done that for nearly, you know, 7 years and I'd done UK for 10 years. It was the longest time I'd spent on any one particular market.
But you clearly knew what you were getting into after all that time. So it was an informed decision or an informed career path you wanted to take following that?
Well, it wasn't actually. I wish I could say that I left knowing I was going to become a coach. I didn't really know. I just, all I knew was that I wasn't really enjoying my job anymore. So I had to just make sure that financially we were not going to be threatened by me leaving my job because I was the only breadwinner in my home. But I think my gut instinct said, just do this and I'm sure something's going to work out. So for me, how I discovered coaching was a thing for me was actually after I wrote my book. I wrote a book and it was about women who found their purpose through following their hearts and, you know, making a few brave decisions. And it was really at the end of that that I guess I kind of made a bit of a journey of self-discovery myself.
These were women you knew personally? Or?
Not all of them. Some of them I knew. I would say about half the women I didn't know. Half of them I kind of knew or knew of or, you know, was familiar with through social media. So it just turned out to be a nice diverse group of women with different backgrounds and different aspirations. And I think when I sat back and I thought, what's the common thread between what I've done all this time and what I love doing? It's actually that spotting of potential and helping in my own little way to help them realize it. And I thought, you know, with companies, it's more complicated because you're only a small part of that transformation. And there are so many external factors that can affect whether that transformation bears fruit or not. On a one-on-one basis, you know, when you're actually talking about individuals, it can be so much more powerful. There's so much more empowerment that you can help with. And I think it was that really that made me think, actually, maybe I could do this. Because I was always a very empathetic person. It was always my style to be willing to listen and to kind of understand where the other person was coming from and actually be able to see things that perhaps they couldn't see about themselves. And those are things I think you need as a coach. So, sorry, long answer.
But does that not require a person you're talking to open up and be, you know, feel a bit comfortable with you to indulge you into, you know, various aspects of their lives?
Absolutely.
And how would you achieve that as a profession if you don't know that person?
So it's a very good question. So I think the thing is that it is a very personalized service. And I think the people who will come to me are drawn to me because of who I am, my approach, what I've done. And, you know, and I think, you know, a lot of that comes through by just being willing to be vulnerable and to be seen. So that's why I do a lot of public speaking engagements. I don't do it for the money, but it's my way of going out there so people will think, you know what, maybe she can help me. And it may be that I can't help you. We don't know that. So I think the first call is always free. It's like a discovery call. And they will tell me a little bit about themselves. I will tell them a bit more about myself and my approach. And then we will agree whether or not it's something I can help with. So I'm very early on this journey. So I'm not going to lead you to believe that I'm already, you know, this successful coach. You know, this.
But give us perhaps an example of how you may have helped an individual. What are some of the tools you have used that have eventually led to somebody getting on the path they should be?
So I'll give you an example of a lady who came to me, and I'd been to do a talk, and it was about my book. But it was not, when I do my talks about my books, I'm quite clear that I don't want it to be a book launch or a book marketing exercise. So I never go in there and try and do a sell job on my book. What I do is I talk about the themes that come out of my book. I talk about some of the things that I've been through, the difficulties I have faced in my life, the setbacks and failures that helped me to discover what I really wanted. And these things make me real, okay? I don't talk about success, because success is very personal to every person. And then as a result of that, this lady came to me afterwards and said, I wonder if I can talk to you as a coach. And I said, okay, let's have a conversation. And we had a conversation, and she was really struggling. She felt like her life was going nowhere in terms of her work and her personal life, and she couldn't quite work out what was causing it or how to get around it. So what we did was, the first session was really her telling me about herself. So by this time, she has already decided that she likes me, she trusts me. A lot of my approach is storytelling. I let people tell their stories, and then I write them down and I send them back to them so they can read their story pretty much in their own words, but with my, maybe a little bit of my sort of observations. Mm-hmm. And that itself can make them see themselves in a different light. So to come back to this woman, you know, she had some issues, you know, and what I asked her to do was some very simple things, and she had to just include them in her life. One of them I said was that I wanted her to become, first of all, more aware of the external environment around her, you know. So I said, if you go for a walk, you spot something that makes you smile, go back and make a note in your journal. Make a note of things that stand out in your day. They could be positive or negative. The other thing I asked her to do was to every day make a new connection. And what I mean by that, I don't mean necessarily go up to some random stranger and start talking to them, although you could do that. But, you know, if you're on the tube and you catch somebody's eye, you make a connection. You may offer them a seat, or you may talk about the weather. I don't know, anything at all. All credit to her, she actually did everything I asked her to do. And I had my second call with her within about 2 weeks, and the change in her was amazing. Because what she had done, by suddenly becoming aware of things that she had not noticed before, she realized there was a lot more positive stuff going on in her life than she had realized. By making connections, she started to talk to people who opened new doors for her, gave her new ideas. And that was literally after just one call.
Professionally, you think then that may have helped her as well?
At the end of our fourth conversation, now she knows what she wants to do. She's discovered what, you know, the root of her issues are. Not all of them are going to be solved by me. None of them are going to be solved by me. She's got to solve them herself. But what I do as a coach is I actually help her to help herself. And that's the main thing. So, you know, I would say if she manages to achieve the goals that she set out at the beginning, it's because of her. It's because she took the things I asked her to do and she took them in the right spirit and she gained from it. And that's an example of how it can work. So it's very much down to the person who comes to me. You know, if they want to change, they have to make an effort. You know, all lasting change needs patience and persistence.
Absolutely. And how would that differ for like a business? So that's an individual that you're trying to show the mirror to and guide them in basically doing what they've always wanted to. But then how does that differ? How does your strategy differ when you're helping out a business or a company?
Yeah.
Reach their goals.
So even businesses are made of people. Mm-hmm. So I think I probably would say that my niche is not the big corporations. So I'm not somebody who wants to do leadership coaching or career transition coaching or anything like that. I want to help small businesses. They could be one or two people businesses, because the thing about being self-employed or being, you know, a small business owner compared to being somebody in a big organization is that you have to do everything yourself, you know, and that's quite a big change. If you've had people who've done IT for you or somebody who does sales and you, you know, you have a role that you fulfill well and that's your job. Then when you become a business owner, you have to learn very quickly on the job, and you may not be very good at doing everything, but you may not know what it is that you're not doing very well. So sometimes it's quite good to have somebody who is not directly connected with your business to help you see that in a way that is non-judgmental and in a way that's very positive and helpful. And so that's how I propose to help small businesses.
So for argument's sake, if you are a small business, as you said, one or two person, you are busy with various aspects of running a business. And if you don't know what you're doing wrong, when would you know that I need help from someone like yourself?
I think you would probably know that because you think that you're doing all this effort and your results are not coming through. So you may think, well, I'm doing all this advertising, I'm spending a load of money on, you know, newspaper ads, but no one's buying my stuff. What am I doing wrong?
Right.
Yeah, so that's one example. So I think you have to sense that actually you don't quite know how to get from the level you are at now to the next level. It doesn't necessarily mean that you are having a problem. You know, it could be your business is ticking along nicely, but you're just not making progress. And, you know, maybe what you want is to be, you know, increasing your revenues year on year, making more of a profit or whatever it might be. So I think for me, the first thing is to find out what it is that they think is not working for them before I can help them, if that makes sense. And sometimes it could be simple things like, I always think that, you know, products and services are very commoditized these days. But what is never commoditized is your personal brand and the service you can offer. And that's not just in business, that's in your everyday dealings with people. And that is something that we as individuals can become more aware of. And I always like to think of it this way. You know, when you look in the mirror, you get a two-dimensional view of yourself. You can only see the bit of yourself that you are able to see. But if somebody was able to give you a multidimensional perspective of how the world sees you, you might see that there are any things positive about you that you didn't know, but equally there will be negative things that you didn't know existed. So being aware of those things is the first step to actually working on them and changing those.
That is quite interesting. There's one thing I think it'd be nice to know about the competition you face in working as a life. And you've got decades of couple of decades of finance experience behind you. And when you go and offer your services or when someone gets in touch with you, do you think it's also to do with your profile or your background? And what do you think? I mean, there are other life coaches around there, business coaches around there. And how do you see it?
Yeah, there's lots of competition. Yeah. But as one of, I think this is one of the great lessons I learned from one of the ladies in my book, that actually competition is a good thing because it means that it's a thriving industry. So, you know, beware of industries where there's nobody there, because it probably means that you can't make money from it. Now, the thing about life coaching and business coaching is that it is, as I said, very personalized. And so the people who will come to me because they're drawn to me. So you're right. So it is partly my profile and, you know, what I put out. And actually, I'm very happy for people to get a glimpse into me, not just as a life coach, but as an author, as a mum. You know, I've written about very personal things on my blog, and I actually allow them access to all of this. So when they come to me, they have a pretty good sense of what sort of person I am. So I think, yeah, there is competition. But I would also say that actually what I want to do is not just empower people on a one-on-one basis, because that's limited to how much time I can give to each person. That's why I want to do workshops. I want to do, you know, speaking events where, you know, you can inspire people through just one little story. Yeah. You know, and you can do that. You can do that through webinars, you know, podcasts. And there are so many ways. And technology gives us such amazing opportunities to reach audiences that would otherwise never get to hear from you. So that's my aim. So it's obviously a source of income for me, because that's how I'm going to make my living. but it's far more than that.
Yeah, very
well. Well, let's rewind your life a little bit. When you're born and brought up in India, so let's understand a bit more about your Indian life, so to speak, and how did you move to UK in what circumstances?
So I was born to a naval officer, and my mum, although would have loved to have a career, but she couldn't because we moved every 2 or 3 years, you know, with my father's job. I think if I look back at my early life, I think I was so lucky because my brother and I were always treated the same. You know, my parents did not treat me differently because I was a girl. They didn't limit my the things I could do because I was a girl. They were also not very pushy. You know, they did not feel that they needed to give me tuitions so I could do super well. Their philosophy always was, look, you put in the effort. You know, if you do well, you get all the credit. If you do badly, you take responsibility for it. And I think it was a fantastic philosophy that I grew up with. I also kind of was told that I should learn to fight my own battles, that they would be there as my safety net, but they were not going to come in and fight my battles for me. Again, another great way to get independent. So we moved around quite a bit, and I, to be honest, I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life. I was quite good with my studies. I was a bit of a swot, and I was probably good at memorizing stuff because that's how we... our exams were, weren't they? They were a test of memory, and I had a good sort of memory for things. But the sad thing was, as soon as I'd done it, I completely forget what I'd learned. So if people now ask me, so what did you learn? I am actually ashamed because I can't remember. However, you know, one thing led to another, and I, after I finished my 12th standard, I decided to do a BSc in maths and statistics, which to my, I remember visiting my physics teacher who had very high hopes of me. And he looked so disappointed because he was hoping I would become a doctor or an engineer, because that's kind of the path you went on if you were, you know, academically doing well.
Right.
But then I did eventually go and do 2 years at IIM Bangalore to do an MBA. And I genuinely thought that at the end of it, I would end up doing a job in marketing at one of the MNCs. But that was not to be. And I came to, instead of going through the... placements where, you know, all my colleagues, classmates were looking for a job, I decided I wasn't going to do that. I was going to visit my parents in London because my father was here as naval attaché in the Indian High Commission. And I thought, you know, this is a great opportunity, probably the only time in my entire life I will get to travel on a diplomatic passport. So let's do it. And so I came here with basically great optimism that I would... wow, the companies here, and that they would give me a job, which was, of course, not to be. But yeah, that was kind of my life in India in a very short nutshell. It was, it was an interesting life. I never ever thought I would live anywhere other than India because I genuinely loved my life there.
So it's interesting you say that when you came here, you felt that you could get pretty much any job, and it wasn't the case. Coming from an A-grade business school in India, doing the IIM and taking the path of, you know, studying there and hoping to make it big, what then was success to you at the time? I mean, and from then to now, how would you define success? How would you tell your children what success is?
I think, to be honest, I didn't really have a sort of big sense of what success would mean. I think for me, success was kind of mini goals being achieved. And at that time, my goal was to just get a job. Because this is before, remember, before the internet and Google and real-time social media, you know, if I had had any sense, I would have researched to see what the economic conditions were in the UK before I came here, assuming I would get a job, because it was one of the worst recessions that the UK was going through in 1991. So I clearly, you know, failed to do my research, and I came here very optimistic and confident. The thing is, at that time, an MBA was really not valued in India. Not India, in England. You know, there were lots of British graduates who were unemployed because there were not enough jobs. And I will be perfectly honest, you know, I realised that I was not ready for the working world in England. I was so raw. I had never worked before. I'd had all this academic knowledge. But if I was to employ myself, I would probably not employ me. And that was a real hard lesson, you know, quite humbling. And I felt quite depressed at the time. And I thought, oh my God, I've missed out on getting a job in India, and now I'm going to go back with nothing to show and probably not get a job. And I genuinely thought I'd probably make history in a not good way by being the only MBA graduate from IIM Bangalore who failed to get a job anywhere. So it was quite depressing. But, you know, then an opportunity did come up to sell, you know, insurance on a commission basis, and I did that. And although it was horrible and hard, and, you know, I didn't make any money at all, but it was probably a fantastic character building exercise for me. And I, you know, it's like, you know, that movie Sliding Doors. Have you ever seen that movie? Like, one small decision changes the entire trajectory of your life. So I had a series of sliding door moments, and basically it just meant that I never went back to India, and I lived here for the next 26 years, and I'm still here.
So I understand you have quite a few passions as well, and the one which is very closest to your heart is charity projects. Can we just understand a bit more on what kind of projects you're involved in on that front?
So I think that, you know, I'm a sort of, although I'm a believer in, you know, a society that is not purely communist or socialist, I think you need businesses to do, to give people incentive to do more. I also think we need responsible capitalism. And so I kind of take it on a personal level as well. I think it's not just expecting businesses to do that. I think we all, if we do manage to meet our basic needs and we do a bit more, then it's down to us to put something back into the community. And so that's kind of always been my motto. And I have, for that reason, supported lots of charities here in the UK. And most of them tend to be relating to children, because children are our future. I think if we can change the life of even one child, who knows, they might be the next Steve Jobs, or, you know, the possibilities are there. So that's kind of been what's informed me. And I think the step to actually start my own charity was probably an unexpected, but now in hindsight, perfectly sensible step, because I had found a project in India I really wanted to support and raise money for. And there was no way to do that in a transparent or tax efficient way other than to create a charity. So that was the start of Raindrop campaign, and from there, you know, it's just opened my eyes to a number of ways in which, you know, I can help.
Would you want to tell us a little bit more about the charity? What do you plan to do, and what's the focus of the charity?
So it's a very, very small charity. It's, you know, the trustees are all people in, you know, full-time jobs, and we just think that binds us is that we have this common interest. So we only take on projects that we feel really comfortable with, that we can then attach our names and reputations to when we go to donors here in the UK to raise money. And I think what we try and do is just keep close to those causes, make sure that they're spending the money and they're getting the outcomes that they said they would. And at the moment, the project we're supporting is in Bangalore, you know, supporting children in slums to help them bridge the gap between not speaking the language, not, you know, being to school ever, to actually going into a mainstream, you know, sometimes a private school, which is a fee-paying school. I think the really important thing is that these people who are running the charity, Samriddhi Trust, actually get the parents interested into the whole project of getting their child educated. They get them invested in it because they pay half the fees, which is incredible considering these people are slum dwellers and have very little money. But I think what that does, it makes them really want their child to succeed. So it's not just charity, someone gave them something and they're TK, you know, they're not going to really try. So I think that's really important. And there's lots of other, you know, aspects of it, like they give them after school support to help them with homework. They give them, you know, after school or between sort of school terms during holidays. They take them on trips and educational guidance and stuff. It's brilliant. And at the end of it all, they give them vocational training to help them actually get a job. So it's not just focused on, you know, go to school and get a, you know, get your qualifications, but actually help them translate that into a life-changing opportunity.
And equipping them with the life skills, which I think are very critical.
Exactly.
Succeed. I think it's been a pleasure talking to you, Rohini, and I'm sure lots of listeners will be able to draw from your experiences and life skills and your work with your business right now, and also with the charities. I think it's a rewarding profession, as you said, and we thoroughly enjoyed ourselves today. So good luck with everything. And
thank you so much. I really enjoyed it too.
Thank you.
Hope you enjoyed listening to this episode. You can catch all upcoming episodes on the website globalize-asian.co.uk or via your iOS or Android devices. Also, if you wish to join us as a speaker and share your story, please do drop us a message via the contact form on the website. That's it for now from Gagan and Vatsala.
Thank you very much, guys, for listening to our podcast. A quick shout out to our supporter for the podcast, Royal Beans. Royal Beans is a premium artisan chocolate brand operating out of the city of Bangalore in India. Currently, they're offering Belgian chocolate bonbons infused with interesting flavors like cappuccino, masala chai, dark chocolate ganache, sea salt caramel, and many more. Just visit their website on royalbeans.in and order for yourself or get it delivered to your loved ones in major cities across India. As a listener of a podcast, you are entitled to get 10% discount on the order value when you use the code GLA10 at the checkout. So go ahead and check it out.